The Young Miss Miller. Pierrette dancing on the green, merrily so merrily. From A Mask from Italy, written by Agatha Christie, in around 1907. Where will one be next year or the year after? How wonderful it is that one doesn't know. From Notes, made by Agatha Christie, in 1973. After the death of her husband, Clara faced the fact that Ashfield would have to be sold. Her children, Agatha in particular, were less realistic. They had not seen the letters from Frederick's executor in New York, Auguste Montant, explaining that there was almost no money left. Clara had nothing except a tiny income from H.B. Chaflin's, the firm at which Nathaniel Miller had been a partner. Running a big house like Ashfield would be a continual strain. To have kept it on was not a wise thing. I see that now, wrote Agatha in her autobiography. Nevertheless, she begged for it, and Clara bowed to her daughter's wishes. Oh, Mother, don't let's ever sell it. Very well, darling. After all, it's a happy house. After losing her husband, a woman may find that the children who are supposed to help her through her loss do the opposite. They take away her rightful desire to think only of herself. Nobody could have cared more about Clara than Agatha did, yet with a child's innate selfishness, she was determined to have her way and make her mother yield. To Agatha, staying at Ashfield meant that nothing had changed. But for Clara, everything had changed. The house was full of memories and bereft of so much else. Had she moved, as she briefly hoped to do, to a different life, she liked the idea of a cozy little house in Exeter, her relationship with her daughter might have been different too. But perhaps she would not have wanted that. She too loved Ashfield with a passion, her own house after all, and staying there was an expression of fidelity to Frederick. The oils he had bought still hung in clusters on the walls. The smell of his cigarettes still hovered, just within imagination, in the flower-scented air. Clara had become like her own mother, Mary Ann, who, after the death of Captain Beamer, never thought to look at another man. But Clara was unlike Mary Ann in that she would now make her daughter the centre of her life. Ashfield was materially changed, of course. It became emptier and shabbier. The staff was reduced to two young, inexpensive maids, although Jane the cook refused to go. I have been here a very long time, she said. When she eventually left to keep house for her brother, she did so with two silent tears rolling down her cheeks. She was completely unable to get to grips with the loss of status that went with Clara's new poverty. It had been her great delight to telephone orders in her deep Devonshire voice, 6 lobsters, hen lobsters, and to create dishes for the gourmand Frederick, who would later step down to the kitchen with a word of graceful private thanks. Now Jane, suffering intensely, found herself tipping avalanches of rock cakes into the bin and cooking macaroni cheese for two. She had to be reminded of the realities, but there was something magnificent in her refusal to admit them. She was like the servant Dorcas in Agatha's first detective novel, The Mysterious Affair at Styles, with her lament to Poirot for older, grander days. 5 gardeners we had before the war, when it was kept as a gentleman's place should be. I wish you could have seen it then, sir. A fair sight it was. But now there's only old Manning and young William, and a new-fashioned woman gardener in breeches and such like. Ah, oh, these are dreadful times. The good times will come again, Dorcas. At least we hope so. For Clara, the good times were now held in her green leather case, repository of memories. Of the young Frederick's smiling visits to the Miller household, of his miraculous proposal, of his arm through hers as they walked the New York streets, of his last letter to her. By the fire, in the upstairs schoolroom, or while they were filling the house with great tall bouquets of white flowers from the garden, Clara told Agatha all these stories of her life. and so they found equilibrium again, mother and daughter, at Ashfield. At the end of Barton Road, Agatha could wind her way downhill through the leafy lanes that led to All Saints' Tor, the great Victorian church where she had been baptized, and say prayers for her father. She was a religious girl, firmly and strictly orthodox. On the way to the church, she passed Vansittart Road, whose name many years later she used for a character, Eleanor Vansittart, in her detective novel Cat Among the Pigeons. Elsa Dittisham, Colonel Luscombe, John Christo, Jean Instow, and Mildred Street bear other place names she remembered from her Devon childhood. She began writing as a young girl. Her earliest surviving poem is carefully inscribed in an exercise book and dated April 1901. There once was a little cowslip, and a pretty flower too, but yet she cried and petted, all for a robe of blue. In the same book, there is a poem about her cat, Ode to Christopher Columbus, written just after the death of her father. There was a little kittywinks, whose name for short was Chris. His fur stood out an inch all round, his tail a dream of bliss. She also had a poem published in an Ealing newspaper, whose first verse began, "When first the electric trams did run, in all their scarlet glory." This was Agatha Christie's first appearance in print. Subsequent poems made it into the Poetry Review, but it was Agatha's sister Madge who had more striking early success as a writer and showed far more early ability. Before her marriage in 1902, she had had several stories, vain tales, published in Vanity Fair. "There is no doubt that Madge was the talented member of our family," wrote Agatha in her autobiography. Both girls were encouraged to write, indeed to express their personalities in any way they chose. At the same time, there was no thought that doing so would impugn their femininity. In that sense, Clara was more enlightened than many women today, who would be quite capable of viewing Madge's Vanity Fair successes as off-putting, threatening, to potential husbands. It is a quirk of parenting, more often than is realized, to treat one's children in the opposite way to which one was treated oneself. Clara had been ignored, had had her sensitive individuality swept aside by her upbringing. Now, she shone a powerful searchlight onto her daughters' lives. She exerted herself to empathize with every aspect of them and believed there was nothing they could not do. She would probably have been a terrible mother for an ordinary girl. As it was, she had two bright sparks, effulgent in Madge's case, and she kindled them to their utmost. The close influence of Clara, her high-minded literary style, lies heavy upon the poems that Agatha wrote, aged around 13. "Have ye walked in the wood today? Have ye trodden the carpet of gold? Have ye heard the wind stirring the leaves at your feet? Have ye felt the mists rising tonight? Have ye wept for the world's disarray? Have ye counted the days that are told?" Madge was freer and always knew her own mind. She was as like Frederick as she was her mother, very much the half-American, with her dry and limber wit, her lax disregard for convention. Unlike Agatha, she felt no need to behave like a good girl, and nobody thought the worse of her for it. She was Bess Sedgwick in At Bertram's Hotel, impatient, adventurous, compelling. Whereas Agatha was Bess's daughter, Elvira, quiet, compliant, infinitely complex. Sent to Paris to be finished, Madge took a dare to leap from the balcony onto a table in a stately tea room. Like her father, she acted in amateur dramatics and loved to dress up, once meeting a visitor in the garb of a Greek priest. This may have given Agatha the idea, often used in her books, that being an actor makes a person an automatic master of disguise. To assume the makeup and part of Pedro Morales was child's play to an actor. Late in life, Madge came down to a family dinner in full cricket gear. Like her mother, she had something restless in her personality, but her abundance, excess, of confidence, meant that in her youth this turned to jokes and creativity. She was magnetic, sexy, quick as a fox. Not beautiful, but that did not matter. She had personality. Agatha was dazzled by her, and as a young girl, she must have been a wonderful audience to whom Madge could show off her new dresses, flaunt her bow, and get laughs with her most throwaway remarks. "Agatha is terribly slow," Madge would say, but with affection. She was fond of her silent little sister. In 1903, Agatha made a second entry in the album of confessions and named Mother and Madge as her heroines. As she grew older, however, she became jealous. "I shall be furious if she arrives on the film before I do," wrote Agatha to her mother in 1922, by which time she herself was a published author. But Madge, without warning and apparently without effort, had written a play for which she casually sought a West End producer. She was also at that point a good deal richer than Agatha. Her marriage to James Watts, one of many suitors who won her interest by appearing uninterested, was as lucrative as her namesake grandmother's had been. James was heir to Abney Hall near Manchester, a vast Victorian mansion where Prince Albert had stayed, and which Agatha used as the setting for several of her books. In After the Funeral, the modern young cook calls the house a proper old mausoleum and complains of the immense area of the kitchen, scullery and larder, saying that it was a day's walk to get round them all. In They Do It With Mirrors, Abney, or Stony Gates, is mocked outright as a sort of Gothic monstrosity, best Victorian lavatory period. In fact, the house was hugely impressive, as Agatha was only too aware. As a child, she had loved to visit what was then the home of James Watts's parents, and "How is our dream child?" Sir James would say to her. Abney had the dimension for which she yearned. It was a world of its own, with a life of its own, seemingly infinite, with its quantities of rooms, passages, unexpected steps, back staircases, front staircases, alcoves, niches. Although Agatha loved sunlight and airiness, she was compelled by Abney's Stygian quality, shrouded as it was from floor to ceiling in brocade curtains and tapestry hangings. Its rooms were shadowy, filled with richness and heaviness. Green satin walls in the drawing room, woodwork painted vermilion and ultramarine, oak furniture like miniature battleships. It had a magic made of depths, recesses, mysteries. Its very solidity seemed not quite real. In They Do It With Mirrors, Stony Gates is likened to a stage set, although the illusion in the eye of the beholder, not in the set itself. After Madge's marriage, Agatha and Clara spent Christmas with the Watts family. Agatha later remembered the bursting stockings, presents heaped on chairs, a dining room that dimpled and glittered with lights, a meal beyond compass, oyster soup, roast turkey, boiled turkey, sirloin of beef, plum pudding, mince pies, trifle, grapes, oranges, plums, preserved fruits. It was the world of the past made flesh, and the Abney image of Christmas was one that Agatha tried to recreate all her life. That plenitude, that Englishness, those Dickensian configurations of gleam and depth. Madge became the chaplain of Abney when James Watts took over the export business established by his grandfather. James, as Agatha's second husband Max put it, had a strange respect for money as a token of man's merit. Although when Agatha first met him in 1901, he was a shy young Oxford undergraduate with no plutocratic tendencies. "I took a great fancy to him at once," she wrote in her autobiography. "He was kind to me, always treating me seriously, and not making silly jokes or talking to me as if I were a little girl." 25 years on, he offered the idea, also claimed by Lord Mountbatten, for her most famous detective novel, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. James' reserve gave him an empathy with Agatha, but made him an odd husband for the extrovert Madge. In later life, she became frankly too much for him. He was unnerved by her penchant for disguise, for instance, and he was certainly not enough for her. "They are an unhappy lot at Abney, I think," Agatha would write in 1930. In her autobiography, Agatha wondered if her sister would have gone on writing if she had not married. So it was probably a relief to Agatha that she did marry. Madge was the kind of woman who nowadays would have felt free to live alone, and that might have suited her best. It is certainly possible she would not have married James if Frederick, who never liked him, had still been alive. But Madge and Agatha had been left £100 each a year from the Miller estate. This was not negligible in the 1910s. Still, the thought of Madge beneath the shelter of Abney must have been an irresistible relief to Clara, who was a realist about money. From her own upbringing, she knew the damage that the lack of it could do. So she encouraged the couple not to wait, and although Madge herself felt this was too soon, the wedding took place 9 months after Frederick's death. Mother said, and truly I think, that it would be even more difficult to part with Madge as time went on, and their companionship drew them closer. In the period between Frederick's death and this marriage, Clara's relationship with Madge had an intimate intensity. They went to the south of France together for 3 weeks, leaving Agatha alone at Ashfield. She did not mind this, enjoyed ordering meals for herself from Jane. Technically, she was the mistress of the house, and dimly understood that a grown woman was a better companion for a new widow than a pious girl bleating inadequately about paradise. Had Madge not married so quickly, Agatha's relationship with Clara might have been rather different. As it was, from 1902 onwards, she was first daughter. Agatha put Madge into her story, The House of Beauty, written around 1908, and the earliest of her works to find subsequent publication. Allegra Kerr mesmerizes the hero John. She was marvelously effective. Her effectiveness was, he thought, more studied than natural. But behind all that, there lay something else. Flickering fire, fitful, capricious, like the will-o'-the-wisps that of old lured men into the marshes. She outdoes her young friend Maisie, who is in love with John, with ease. "You are hateful, Allegra," Maisie tells her. "But stimulating, darling." In Unfinished Portrait, there is a version of Monty, but no Madge character. Celia's sister Joy dies young. Agatha did not want Madge's dominant personality in the book, interfering with her own relationship with her mother, doing so many things better than she did. Flirting, joking, telling stories, painting, acting, writing. When Madge's play The Claimant was taken up by a West End management, it went on at the Queen's Theatre, Shaftesbury Avenue, in 1924. Agatha was obliged to be delighted for her. But the balance of their relationship, which for the past 4 years had been redressed by Agatha's literary successors, had tipped again. It is a rare writer who is not competitive, and an even rarer sister. Agatha had the sense that Madge, having touched her toe on the accelerator for one quick second, had leapt instant miles ahead of her. She had believed Madge to be under control, thick of waist, mother to her grown-up son, Jack born in 1903, locked away in her funereal mansion, while her terribly slow sister won plaudits from the outside world. She should have known better. When the 18-year-old Madge had played the confessions game, she had written that her idea of happiness was to be successful. It was an idea that she had not yet quite abandoned. And with that blithe glee, she rubbed it in during rehearsals for The Claimant. The play was based on the true story of Sir Charles Tichborne, a Victorian Martin Gere, who had laid claim to a baronetcy in the 1870s and gone on trial to establish his identity. Madge delighted in the fun of the story, although she treated its complexities with a lighter and more ragged touch than Agatha would have done. Inexperienced dramatists are apt to be over-lavish with their plots, read the generally favorable review in the Times. It was a remarkable thing for an amateur to have pulled off, another triumph in a sense for Clara, who would have instilled in Madge the certainty that she could write a West End play. And Madge relished every moment of the experience. In the Confessions game she had said that London was the place she most wanted to live. Aged 45, she was there at last, staying at the Garden Club in Mayfair, taking her vast reserves of assurance to the theatre every morning and bamboozling producer Basil Dean with them. Accustomed as he was to desperate actors and neurotic playwrights, the nonchalant grandeur of Mrs. Watts charmed him half to death, or so she told her family. "My two darlings," she wrote to her husband and son at Abney, "it's going so well that Basil Dean says it might be produced earlier. I think the end of Act Three is soft, always did think so. I want Fay Compton to have a speech. Asked B.D., and he said, 'Do exactly what you like. If you like, you can make it terrific anyway. Anything you do, I'm for.' Very surprising. So, I'm typing again. I went into Brown's Hotel again. Said how I wanted rooms not for 16th, but 11th. They were full, but on my mentioning the play, she went quite mad and said, 'Of course you shall have rooms, no matter who is turned out. Gives one a sheer sense of power. I hope I don't get very swell-headed.'" Agatha was then living at Sunningdale, not far from London, so Madge spent some weekends with her. "I went to Sunningdale yesterday, Sunday, but I was so tired I kept dropping off to sleep all the time." It is possible that she was rather tiring herself at that time, especially to Agatha, who, according to Madge, was mad to see a rehearsal, probably in order to reassure herself that The Claimant was no masterpiece. The tone of Madge's letters shows how irritating she must have been to her sister. "Wrote and typed all night. B.D. came back in about 5 minutes, seized me by the arm and said, 'My God, you can write. It's magnificent.' So that's that. He now thinks I'm a sort of genius. They can't do without me." This was Madge's particular and provoking idiom. It could annoy to distraction, but it could also charm. That she was the only woman in her family with her father's innate sense of humour is shown in this letter about the actress Lottie Venn, who had been cast in The Claimant for the natural barmaid qualities, that, as she was playing an aristocrat, she felt at pains to suppress. "I've an awful job this afternoon. I've got to tell Lottie Venn, orders from B.D., that she is to be vulgar. She said, 'Of course, as a duchess I can't do this or that.' Frightfully pleased at being one." Madge described the meeting thus: "Dear Miss Venn, I'm so charmed to meet you. I'm dreadfully afraid everyone who's coming only to see you will be so disappointed. They don't want to see my duchess, they want to see you. They want their Louis. Me, I don't care about my lines. You must put yourself into the part. Let yourself go. Take it broadly. Miss V. But a duchess, you know. Never have I found it so difficult to keep serious." Agatha could not have written this, could not have been the woman who wrote it. She must have known deep down that such a direct expression of personality on the page is not the mark of a real writer. And she thought that she saw what lay beneath Madge's constantly rippling laughter. "I've always suspected," says a character in her late Westmacott, The Rose and the Yew Tree, "that a sense of humour is a kind of parlour trick we civilised folk have taught ourselves as an insurance against disillusionment. We make a conscious effort to see things as funny, simply because we suspect they are unsatisfactory." Yet for all this, Mad could always make Agatha feel curiously colourless, like her imaginary self, Sue de Vert. "My aunt was more entertaining than my mother," said Agatha's daughter Rosalind. "She was great fun, slightly buried in Manchester." After The Claimant came to the end of its short run, Madge returned to her vast, crypt-like house. She wrote a couple more plays, but nothing else was produced. Instead, it was Agatha who moved into the West End, where she achieved a remarkable dominance. It was as if a particular rivalry had to be settled in her favour, although there was a quality in both Madge and the claimant, that sweet, airy essence of self that would always elude her. With a true lightness of touch, for example, the play portrays a character called Charles Cleghorn. "Don't care about coppers, never did," he says, tossing his small change onto the stage. Not that this was art exactly on Madge's part. It was a clever, elliptical and faithful reproduction of her brother Monty. Monty never cared about small change, nor indeed about much else, or so he affected to pretend. He was a hopeless case. The matriarchy within which he grew up overwhelmed him.
"I mean, it makes you feel an awful ass," says Eustace Leonides, the young boy in Crooked House, who lives in a family full of powerful women.
This was the line that Monty took. His natural idiom was that of the old Harrovian, but as with Eustace, the sense of inadequacy went deeper. Eustace has suffered from infantile paralysis, and this is given as the explanation for his injured male pride and possible murderousness. "The more I think about it, the more it seems to me that Eustace might fit the bill. He's not normal." With Monty, there was no outward illness, but there was within an odd paralysis of the spirit. A normal man could have thrived or survived among all those women, since there was no lack of love for him in the family. Frederick adored him as the only boy. "Monty, I think, was really his favourite," wrote Agatha in her autobiography. "But his closeness in age to the bright and brilliant Madge has started him off on the wrong foot. Thereafter he limped along, finding his way through life with a certain careless confidence and great dashes of luck. From Harrow, where he kept white mice, Mr. and Mrs. Whiskers, and took no exams, it was hoped that he would go into banking. But this was beyond him, and he was sent into a shipbuilding yard on the Dart. This, too, proved a failure. When the Second Boer War broke out in 1899, he volunteered for the army, and having obtained a commission in the East Surreys, went to India. Army life suited him better than anything else would have done. But when he resigned his commission in around 1910, it became clear that here was a quite extraordinary misfit. Having come of age just after the death of his father, he ran at speed through the tiny amount left in the Miller estate. He acquired such desperate debts that he moved first to Kenya, then to Uganda, and sent begging letters to Madge, asking for help in a scheme to run cargo boats on Lake Victoria. The Batenga was built with Watt's money. "My brother-in-law was livid," Agatha later wrote. But by the time it was completed, with wildly luxurious ebony and ivory fittings, the First World War had broken out. Monty sold the boat at a loss and joined the King's African Rifles. He narrowly avoided a court-martial when, against orders, he stopped his convoy of mules at a place he insisted was perfect for battle. While in the act of arguing with his commanding officer, a force of Germans arrived and was triumphantly beaten in what became known as Miller's Battle. Then Monty was wounded in the arm. The wound became infected, and he returned to Ashfield with his African servant, Shabani. He had come home, supposedly, to die. In fact, his return nearly killed my mother, as Agatha wrote in her autobiography. Monty would eat dinner at 4 in the morning, if the whim took him, and shoot at people out of the window with his revolver. Calm, silent Barton Road had never known the like. "Some silly old spinster going down the drive with her behind wobbling. Couldn't resist it." There was a self-consciousness about his eccentricity that made it almost boring, as well as terrifying, and harder still to endure. Agatha and Madge were frantic for their mother, who had longed for her son's return, and now longed for him to leave. In the early 1920s, the sisters paid £800 for a cottage at Throwley on Dartmoor, where Monty lived with his 65-year-old housekeeper, Mrs. Taylor, a peroxide blonde
with 13 children. A few years later, Mrs. Taylor died as she was moving with Monty to the south of France. Rooms had been taken for them there again by Agatha and Madge. Now Madge defied her husband's cold fury to travel to Marseille and do something for her brother, who pleaded that he was greatly weakened and lying alone in hospital. In fact, the nurse who looked after him, Charlotte, had become the last to fall for his pitiable charm. Madge arrived to find him living in the nurse's flat. He was with Charlotte until he died in 1929, from a sudden stroke, while having a drink in a seafront cafe. His death was probably a relief to his sisters. Nevertheless, Agatha felt a kind of guilt about Monty. The chaos of his life haunted her, although he may have been less unhappy than she imagined. She sent occasional sums of money to ensure the upkeep of his grave in Marseille, and was anxious that flowers should be placed there on Armistice Day. "You may rest assured it will be well looked after," wrote one of Monty's fellow East Surreys in 1936. Would Monty himself have cared? He grew up with love all around him, but the acceptance shown by his parents, the sense of responsibility felt by his sisters, made no difference in the end. None of it could fill the gaps. Perhaps that was why, when he filled in the album of confessions in 1897, he wrote that his favorite virtue was integrity. It was the quality he lacked above all others, although he did have others. He had all his father's charm, though less of his humor and almost none of his moral sense, and he was not without self-knowledge. When asked whom he would be if not himself, his answer was, a better man. His chief characteristics, he wrote, were skylarking and flirting, whittling, obstinacy, talking slang, and getting into tempers. His idea of misery was working and borrowing money. His heroes were Fenians, his heroines Margaret Miller, Gran, and Clara. His present state of mind was described as, oh my. Pathetic answers, really. So unlike the sharp, crisp responses of his sister Madge. And the picture in which he sits behind a harnessed goat in the cart True Love, dressed in full coachman's regalia, is just the sort of joke that Madge might have conceived, but she would have pulled it off with an assured gleam in her eye. Monty looks merely silly. In another photograph, he is in uniform, sitting on a bamboo bench at Ashfield, his legs hooked over those of two young men at either side of him, his eyes full of a confused zest for life. The last picture shows him outside his cottage on Dartmoor. He is leaning on a stick, wearing a dressing gown, cravat, and mangled hat, a cigarette dropping from his mouth. He looks dissolute beyond measure. A Lord Lucan discovered in sick old age, but a certain ashen charm survives. Agatha was acutely aware of this charm, and having been under its spell, she came to understand its nature. As a child, when Monty had dismissed her scathingly as the scrawny chicken, she had found him hopelessly glamorous. He was the best-looking of the Millers. Adult life had taught her that a man could be weak, yet irresistible. Her last Westmacott novel, The Burden, has a young girl in love with just such a man. She still found it delightful to be married to Henry, but she perceived that it had its disadvantages. Henry had by now had four different jobs. It never seemed difficult for him to get a job. He had a large circle of wealthy friends, but it seemed quite impossible for him to keep a job. Either he got tired of it and chucked it, or it chucked him. Also, Henry spent money like water and never seemed to have any difficulty in getting credit. His idea of settling his affairs was by borrowing. As a small boy, Monty would receive his pocket money for the week and spend it all instantly. Later in the week, he would suddenly push my sister into a shop, quickly order 3 pennies of a favourite sweet, and then look at my sister, daring her not to pay. Madge, who had a great respect for public opinion, always did. Naturally, she was furious about it. Monty would merely smile at her serenely and offer her one of the sweets. 20 years later, when Monty took money from James Watts with which to build a boat, he also used it to set himself up in style at Jermyn Street Hotel, buying silk pajamas and a bonsai tree for his room. To placate Madge, he spent large amounts of her husband's money on giving her presents and lunch at the Barclay. It was the same trick he had pulled as a boy, and Agatha would later write of the terrible sadness of a grown man with the mentality of a child. One must put away childish things. Yes, a man who is a child is the most frightening thing in the world. Agatha learned a good deal from Monty. Her large, somber eyes took in the smiling anxiety of her father, the baffled frustration of her mother, Madge's concerned contempt. Even when Monty was away from home, the problem of him supposedly solved, Agatha was aware of the weak, dark presence that trickled through her family. She understood him, insofar as it was possible. He informed her views on human nature, helped to make her the wise realist of her detective fiction. In wartime, a man like that is a hero. But in peace, well, in peace, such men usually end up in prison. They like excitement, they can't run straight, and they don't give a damn for society. And finally, they've no regard for human life. This is from Taken at the Flood, and does not quite describe Monty. He was not a criminal, and he was capable of affection. But he belonged to the type, often portrayed in her books, and sometimes a killer, of the man who could have made something of his life, were it not for a mysterious inner fallibility. A slightly different arrangement of genes, wrote Agatha in her autobiography of Monty, and he might have been a great man. David Hunter in Taken at the Flood, Philip Lombard in And Then There Were None, Mike Rogers in Endless Night, Charles Arundel in Dumb Witness, Michael Raphael in Nemesis, Leonard Vole in Witness for the Prosecution, Jacko Argyle in Ordeal by Innocence. They all have something of Monty in them. Jacko Argyle is of particular interest. He is one of the 5 children adopted by Rachel and Leo Argyle, each of whom is given an upbringing of perfect regularity, in the belief that they will become well-adjusted little Argyles and fuse as a family. Yet they remain disparate, dissimilar, true to their heredity and origins. Jacko, for all the love and attention lavished upon him, grows up seductive and conscienceless. Jacko, the intrinsic human being. Was Jacko, in the words of the old Calvinistic doctrine, a vessel appointed to destruction? He'd been given every chance in life, hadn't he? Dr. McMaster's opinion, at any rate, was that he was one of those who are born to go wrong. No environment could have helped him or saved him. Was that true? Leo Argyle had spoken of him with indulgence, with pity. How had he put it? One of nature's misfits. That was how Agatha saw Monty. She believed in the essential man, where am I with God's mark upon my brow? And she believed that her brother, like Jacko Argyle, was essentially unsalvageable. The modern view that upbringing forges nature was not one she shared. Of course, she knew that circumstance could make a difference. She herself was the product of a particular set of variables that had pushed her character one way rather than another. Character, mon cher, does not stand still. It can gather strength. It can also deteriorate, says Hercule Poirot in Taken at the Flood. But later in the book he says, the tragedy of life is that people do not change. This is a mantra with Poirot. In Cards on the Table, he refuses to accept a confession of murder that he knows to be false, saying, I am right. I must be right. I am willing to believe that you killed Mr. Shaitana, but you cannot have killed him in the way you say you did. No one can do a thing that is not dans son caractère. Poirot is voicing the ideas of his creator. Agatha had an absolute belief that each person had an immutable essence, usually unknown even to themselves. What a person really is only apparent when the test comes, that is, the moment when you stand or fall on your own feet. Monty fell, and would always fall. Only his charm held him up. In They Do It With Mirrors, Agatha addressed the post-war faith in the power of philanthropy to change lives, partly because of Monty. She found it wanting. The book is set in and around a school for young offenders, run by a man named Louis Sericold, another man with ideals, who attempts to rehabilitate social misfits through psychiatry and education. Louis is bitten by that same bug of wanting to improve everybody's lives for them. And really, you know, nobody can do that but yourself. Miss Marple talks to him about his belief in social engineering. I think sometimes, you know, one can overdo things. I mean, the young people with a good heredity and brought up wisely in a good home, and with grit and pluck and the ability to get on in life, well, they are really, when one comes down to it, the sort of people a country needs. Not that I don't appreciate real compassion, and one should have compassion. It is born in a man to be happy, and into others to be unhappy, Monty himself wrote in 1924. After all, if every other member of his family could write, why shouldn't he? Why not create stories as his clever sisters did? During the time he spent in a cottage on Dartmoor, he covered page after page of a notebook. To me, is at last given understanding, sufficient to carry through my project. Wait and you shall see. It's all going to be so simple you will wonder why. Read and learn, learn and read. He started several poems, plays, and stories in his notebook, usually writing no more than a few lines of each. One story, Black Ivory, begins with Monty lying wounded in Africa. His servant gives him two little brown tablets. What are they? I asked. Opium. Do you good. It has been said that Monty was addicted to drugs, and although there is no outside evidence for this, his own words suggest that he took them at some point, not least because so much of what he wrote reads like hallucination. The glorious dream may happen to any, but better by far to happen to me. Oh, come, oh, come, oh, come away to play, I say, I've dreamed, a dream, I say. Today or tomorrow, there will be no sorrow. Yet within these ramblings, there is a desperate search for meaning and structure. It's a long time since I have felt so thoroughly dissatisfied with my own arrangements for living, he wrote on Dartmoor. It seems to me we many just follow my leader, and not in any way one's inclinations. Those poverty-bound can't help themselves, but an individual. There is a lot in this world how many of us are individuals. Surprisingly few. Tomorrow I begin the search for freedom, true happiness, and true selfishness. Tomorrow.